Welcome to Judaism Demystified, a podcast for the perplexed. We are joined by Dr. William Lane Craig. Dr. Craig is visiting scholar of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology and professor of philosophy at Houston Christian University. Dr. Craig pursued his undergraduate studies at Wheaton College and graduate studies at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, the University of Birmingham, and the University of Munich. From 1980 to 1986, he taught philosophy of religion at Trinity, during which time he and his wife Jan started their family. In 1987, they moved to Brussels, Belgium, where Dr. Craig pursued research at the University of Louvain until assuming his position at Talbot in 1994. He has authored or edited over 30 books, and in 2016, Dr. Craig was named by the best schools as one of the 50 most influential living philosophers. Without further ado, Dr. Craig. Thank you for joining the Judaism Demystified podcast. It is an honor and privilege to have with us Dr. William Lane Craig. First of all, for our audience, would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I am a Christian philosopher. I have a position at Talbot School of Theology in California and at Houston Christian University in Texas. I'm also the president of an online ministry called reasonablefaith.org, and am involved in the philosophical and theological exploration of Christian theism.
Thank you very much. And for those listening, my favorite interview that I've seen with Dr. Craig is with Roger Penrose. I recommend all of you tune into that one. That was a great one. So first, my first question is, would you elucidate your stance on creation ex nihilo, that is creation from nothing, integrating perspectives from both theological doctrine and contemporary scientific understanding, particularly in relation to the Big Bang theory?
Mm-hmm. I think that Genesis 1:1 implies logically creatio ex nihilo, that is to say, the doctrine that God created the universe, but not out of any kind of material substratum. The initial verse of Genesis says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the word there, bara, for created, is a word that has only God as its subject and does not require any sort of material substratum. And the expression, the heavens and the earth, is an idiom in the Hebrew language denoting the entire universe, the entirety of physical reality. So at face value, verse 1 teaches that God, at the very beginning, created the entire physical universe. And I think that verse 1 is neither a subordinate clause, it is an independent clause, and nor the title of chapter 1, but it is providing background information for verses 2 and following. So I think right from the very first verse of the Bible, you have a teaching of creatio ex nihilo, and this is confirmed then in the prophets such as Isaiah and other passages in the Hebrew Bible. And in connection with modern scientific understanding, the ancient Jewish commitment to creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, put Judaism in conflict with Greek philosophical thought, which taught the past eternity of the universe, and materialism, that matter has always existed. And for thousands of years, this Jewish point of view stood in opposition to this mainstream view of materialism from ancient Greek materialism up through modern Marxism and materialistic theories of the universe. This, however, was dramatically upended in the second decade of the 20th century, when Albert Einstein applied his newly discovered gravitational theory, the general theory of relativity, to the universe as a whole. And to his shock and the shock of everyone else, it was discovered that the general theory of relativity would not permit a past eternal universe. Rather, the equations indicated that the universe is expanding, and that as you trace the expansion back in time, the universe becomes denser and denser until at a point in the finite past, it literally disappears. There is an absolute beginning, not only of all matter and energy, but of physical space and time themselves. And so, completely contrary to expectation, contemporary astrophysics confirmed the ancient Jewish view of the beginning of the universe and its origination ex nihilo.
Amazing. Amazing.
So regarding the concept of ex Dio, the idea that the universe emerged from God and is inherently united with his own being, while we both align against panentheism, could you explore any interpretations within the biblical narrative, specifically the Old Testament or Tanakh, that refute this perspective? Furthermore, could you delineate the reasons why both panentheism and pantheism stand in contradiction to our faiths, prefacing your explanation with a clarification of these terms for our audience?
Okay, so let's begin with a clarification of terms for the sake of the audience. Pantheism means that the entire universe, all physical reality, is itself God. It identifies the physical universe with God. Pantheism is characteristic of many Eastern religions, which deny that there is a transcendent creator of the universe who exists beyond space and time, who is himself immaterial, and who brings all physical reality into being. Panentheism, by contrast, is the view that physical reality exists in God. It doesn't exhaust God's being. It's not identical to God, as in pantheism, but it says that everything is in God. The physical universe somehow, in some mysterious ways, emanates out of the very beginning of God, out of the very being of God. So even if God is more than the universe, he is nothing less than the universe. The universe emanates or proceeds out of the very being of God. Now, these worldviews or perspectives, I think, are both antithetical to theism, which is taught in the Judeo-Christian tradition. We saw that the Bible begins with the words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." For God to create the material universe out of himself, he would himself have to be material. But that contradicts the fundamental teaching of the Hebrew Bible that God is spirit rather than material reality. The word that is used for God over and over again in the Hebrew Bible is ruach, spirit. And this characterizes the being of God in contrast to, say, flesh or bashar. That word bashar is never used of God in the Hebrew Bible, whereas ruach is used some 136 times of God in the Hebrew Bible and indicates the antithesis between spirit and materialism. And the most theologically significant use of ruach or spirit is for spiritual beings or spiritual agents, that is to say, agents without bodies. And I'm thinking here of the use of ruach to describe first human spirits. When human spirits are described apart from the body, when the body has died and is laid in the earth, human spirits continue to exist and are referred to as being ruach, spirits. In addition to that, ruach is used of non-human, finite spiritual beings, such as angels or demons, which are also personal agents without bodies. And then finally, as I indicated, the preeminent use of Ruach in the Hebrew Bible is of God himself. God is a spiritual being. He is an immaterial reality who transcends the physical world and has created the physical world. So I think that panentheism, not to say pantheism, is completely incompatible with the conception of God in the Hebrew Bible.
Fascinating. And I actually wanted to point out, there's a famous verse that says, holy, 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 God is, his honor fills the world. I'm paraphrasing it. But basically the real translation of kadosh, which is holy, is actually sanctified or separate. Like God is separate. It's a separate. Hashem tivakot meloko la'aretz kevodo. His honor fills the world. Meaning to say that it's not him who fills the world. It's his, we can see evidence for his, you know, his glory or his honor or his intelligence. We see evidence for that in the world, but it's not him. That's a very important verse I feel like people should really analyze. But thank you so much. That was really, really fascinating. So another topic I want to get into is the accusation from atheistic circles that often centers around theists resorting to a God of the gaps argument for phenomena unexplained by science. Interestingly, some atheists appear to embrace the concept of an eternal universe, potentially through the unverifiable notion of a multiverse, to circumvent the implications of the Big Bang, yet dismiss the plausibility of God's eternality. Notably, figures like Richard Dawkins have posited that the complexity observed in DNA suggests an intelligent designer, albeit ascribing it to extraterrestrial origin rather than a divine entity. Could you address this apparent science of the gaps contradiction and share your compelling arguments for theism when confronting atheistic critiques?
All right. There are a number of facets to the question that you've asked. First of all, I think it's very important to understand that the basis for belief in creation out of nothing is not science. It is the Bible. The Bible teaches creatio ex nihilo. And for millennia, Jews and Christians have believed this doctrine wholly apart from modern science. It wasn't until roughly 100 years ago that we had scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe. So the basis for the belief in creation out of nothing is biblical teaching, not science. The question for the Bible believer then is this biblical teaching at odds with the deliverances of modern science, or is it in accord with the deliverances of modern science? And here it's indisputable, I think, that the doctrine of creation out of nothing is certainly in accord with modern science. Whether or not it's proved by modern science is irrelevant. The Jew or Christian who comes to the table with his biblical theism firmly in hand is adopting a position concerning the origin of the universe that is right at the center of contemporary cosmogony and astrophysics. There is no discord between the belief in creatio ex nihilo and contemporary science, even if one doesn't regard modern science as a positive proof of creatio ex nihilo. Now, with respect to this idea of a God of the gaps argument, I think it's very important to understand that arguments that appeal to scientific evidence are not using God to be a stopgap to plug up the holes in our scientific understanding of reality. Rather, the proper way to view these arguments is that science can provide evidence in support of a premise in a philosophical argument leading to a conclusion of theological significance. Let me repeat that just to make it clear. Science can provide evidence in support of a premise in a philosophical argument for a conclusion that has theological significance. So, for example, take the Kalam cosmological argument, which has been defended historically by Jews, Muslims, and Christians. This argument is very simple. Premise one is that the universe, premise one is that whatever begins to exist has a cause of its beginning. Premise two is that the universe began to exist. And then three, the conclusion is therefore the universe has a cause of its beginning. And you can then do a conceptual analysis of what it is to be a cause of the universe, and a number of theologically striking properties can be recovered from such an analysis. Now, notice that the second premise of that argument, the universe began to exist, is a religiously neutral statement that can be found in any textbook on astronomy and astrophysics. To claim that the scientific evidence supports this premise is not in any way to postulate a God of the gaps. This is a theologically neutral premise, which has, I think, really compelling scientific evidence in its support. So someone who uses the scientific evidence in support of a premise in an argument for a theological conclusion is not postulating God of the gaps reasoning, that is to say, using God to stop up the gaps in our scientific knowledge. This argument is based on what we do know about the universe. It is based on what contemporary science does tell us about the past, namely that the universe is in all probability not past eternal, but had an absolute beginning a finite time ago. Now, you spoke of a kind of science of the gaps that is often used by naturalists in response to arguments of this sort. And I wouldn't characterize that, Ben, as science of the gaps. I don't think this is an opposition between theism and science in any way. Rather, I would characterize it as a naturalism of the gaps. Naturalism is the view that there are no supernatural entities, particularly there is no God, that all that exists is just space-time and its contents. And I think it is a kind of naturalism of the gaps that motivates a lot of these desperate attempts to avoid where the evidence points. And here, I think that's evident in that there would be no reason to resist where the evidence is pointing, for example, the beginning of the universe, if it were not for the fact that these naturalists see where that's leading, leads to an unacceptable conclusion, and therefore they have a kind of naturalism of the gaps that whatever caused the universe or whatever the evidence is, somehow the universe is not past eternal, despite the fact that all the evidence points in that direction. And so I would ask them, apart from the presupposition of naturalism, which is to beg the question, why resist where the evidence points? Why not accept where the evidence points, which is that the universe is not past eternal, but had a beginning? Now, in terms of the arguments for theism that one might present, I have presented multiple arguments for theism, only some of which appeal to scientific evidence in support of some of its premises. Let me just list some of these arguments for you. Number one, I think that God is the best explanation for why anything at all exists rather than nothing. This version of the cosmological argument doesn't appeal to scientific evidence. Rather, it's a purely philosophical argument that at the basis of all reality, there must be a metaphysically necessary being which is distinct from the universe and supplies a sufficient reason why the universe exists. The second argument would be that God is the best explanation for the origin of the universe at a point in the finite past. This is the Kalam cosmological argument to which I've already alluded. And I think it has both philosophical and scientific evidence in support of its key premises. The third argument would be the argument from the uncanny applicability of mathematics to physical phenomena. Why is it that the physical phenomena of this world are describable by elegant mathematical equations that are incomprehensible in their accuracy and so valuable in their utility. This argument from the applicability of mathematics has been defended in our day by the Jewish philosopher Mark Steiner in his book, The Applicability of Mathematics as a Philosophical Problem. Fourth would be that God is the best explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe for embodied conscious agents like ourselves. The fine-tuning of the universe refers to the fundamental constants and quantities that were simply given in the Big Bang itself that show that the universe is fine-tuned to an exquisite precision for the existence of embodied conscious agents like us against all probability, given naturalism. The fifth argument would be that God is the best explanation for the objectivity of moral values and moral duties in the world. Again, this is not a scientific argument. It's a philosophical argument that appeals to our moral experience. We sense that certain things are really right and really wrong, really good and really evil. And the best explanation for the objectivity of the moral values and duties that we grasp are that these are grounded in God, who is the paradigm of moral goodness and whose commands constitute for us our moral obligations. The sixth argument would be that the very possibility of God's existence entails that God exists. This is the famous ontological argument of St. Anselm, and I'm persuaded that a sound and plausible version of the ontological argument can be formulated such that the atheist has to deny not merely that God exists, he has to deny that it's even possible that God exists. So long as God's existence is even possible, the argument shows that that entails that God exists. And then finally, I think that God can be personally known and experienced. This isn't really an argument for God's existence, but it's the claim that wholly apart from arguments, you can know that God exists by having a personal relationship with God. And so for all of these reasons, I think that we have a powerful cumulative case for believing that God exists.
So I want to just ask a few questions on this, and Zev also has questions on this particular
segment.
So what is the argument of the multiverse theory? And like, for example, the fine tuning, they seem to be trying to kind of dismiss that by saying that, well, this universe that we live in particular happens to be fine tuned, but the other ones are not. So how does that work? I'm trying to understand like the logic. Maybe Zev would understand it better.
I think I can make this very clear to our listeners. If you have just one roulette wheel spinning, then the probability that you're going to come up with just a particular number like the red 20 is very remote. But if you have hundreds, thousands, not to say millions of roulette wheels all spinning at the same time, then the chances are that in at least one of them that the red 20 is going to come up. And if getting the red 20 is a necessary condition of your existing, then of course anybody that is alive is going to observe the red 20, because the other universes that are not fine-tuned would be unobservable. You wouldn't exist in them, so you couldn't observe them. And so the claim is that if you multiply your probabilistic resources sufficiently, that anything can be explained away on the basis that there is this infinite multiverse of worlds, so that fine-tuned worlds will appear somewhere in this world ensemble, and those are the only ones that are observable. And therefore, there's nothing here to be surprised about or to be explained. Now, Roger Penrose has raised an objection to this multiverse explanation of fine-tuning that I think is really devastating. What he points out is that it is not true that only fine-tuned worlds are observable. You can have worlds that are not fine-tuned for the existence of embodied conscious agents like us, but that which would be still observable. There could be freak observers that could observe their worlds. These are often called
Boltzmann brains, or
yes.
Okay.
These are often called Boltzmann brains after the great 19th century Austrian physicist Ludwig Boltzmann. And these Boltzmann brains would be just a brain that fluctuates into existence, say out of the quantum vacuum, and just exists for a little time with illusory perceptions of an external world around it. But in fact, the Boltzmann brain is the only thing that exists, and the rest of the universe is all an illusion of this brain. Well, that kind of universe is incomparably more probable than a finely tuned universe like ours, and yet it is observable. And so on the multiverse hypothesis, it leads to a radical skepticism about the world around us, that the atheist would have to believe that he is all that exists, and that the rest of the universe, his own body, his wife, other people, are just illusions of his own consciousness. Well, no sane person believes that he's a Boltzmann brain. And yet, if the multiverse hypothesis is true, there's no way to distinguish between a normal, decent observer like ourselves and a Boltzmann brain. And therefore, this is really, I think, a devastating objection to the rationality of the multiverse hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, that almost sounds like solipsism, like, you know, which is insane.
But, it is solipsism, that's right. You would be the only thing that exists, and everything else is an illusion of your consciousness.
Exactly. And I love how you, the arguments you marshaled in favor of God basically being the final theory of everything. I had two questions on two of the points. There was one about the column cosmological argument. I know that the second point about everything that begins to exist, that has obviously, in some circles, is more controversial.
Yes.
So I would be curious to hear what you say about that. So I'll take that question first. That'll be
yes. Let's review. The first premise is that everything that begins to exist has a cause of its beginning. Now, as you say, I think that's hardly controversial. Things don't just pop into existence out of nothing. Out of nothing, nothing comes. So if something begins to exist, there must be a cause that brings that thing into being. I think that's quite perspicuous. So the more controversial premise is the second one, that the universe began to exist. And here I would marshal both philosophical arguments as well as scientific arguments in support of this premise. Concerning philosophical arguments, a medieval Jewish philosopher like Sadia Ben Gayon defended arguments for the beginning of the universe on purely philosophical grounds, showing that there cannot have been an infinite regress of past events. And therefore, Sadia claimed there must have been an absolutely first event, which was brought into being by a transcendent creator. And I'm persuaded that these purely philosophical arguments are sound arguments and have defended them in my published work. What is incredible is that since the second decade of the 20th century, there has been accumulating increasingly scientific evidence or confirmation of this second premise. And I have reference here to two things. First would be the discovery of the expansion of the universe and the Big Bang model of the origin of the universe, which shows that the universe cannot be past eternal, but must have had an absolute beginning. Over the decades since this was first proposed in the 1920s, there has been a parade of alternative theories trying to avert the beginning of the universe predicted by the Standard Model. We've seen oscillating models, vacuum fluctuation models, steady state models. And over again, these theories have been shown to be either mathematically untenable or physically impossible, or they actually wind up implying the very origin of the universe that they sought to avoid. And so the evidence is such that a cosmologist like Alexander Vilenkin, a preeminent astrophysicist at Tufts University, can say that all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. Now, that's a remarkable statement. Think about it. Vilenkin does not say that the evidence for a beginning outweighs the evidence against a beginning. No, he says all the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. In fact, I'm not aware of any evidence that the universe is past eternal. What evidence we have is all on one side of the scale. And so I think that makes it highly probable that, in fact, the second premise is true, that the universe began to exist. In addition to that, there's also scientific confirmation from the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics shows that the universe cannot be projected into past infinity. Rather, there must have been a beginning a finite time ago in which the energy of the universe was simply put in as an initial condition. And since then, the energy level has been running down just like a clock that has been wound up and is gradually running down. And so we have very positive and powerful scientific evidence in support of that second premise that the universe began to exist.
And even if we go past, because I know that this is a little bit out of my depth, but I know you discussed this with Roger Penrose, that there's time, there's like ordinary space-time, and then there's, of course, before that, you could still, there's still cause and effect in the sense of temporal order time. Is that correct? Like even if we were to say before the Big Bang, there would be time in a certain sense.
In physical cosmology, Ben, there is no time before the Big Bang. That is inept to say what was before the Big Bang. That's like asking what is north of the North Pole. The initial cosmological singularity in the Standard Model simply represents the beginning of time, and space-time cannot be projected further backwards than that. Now, as a philosopher, however, and metaphysician, I think it is coherent to talk about a sort of metaphysical time that existed prior to the inception of physical time. And I think a knockdown argument for that would be that God could count down to the moment of creation. -3, -2, -1, let there be light. And in that case, there would be a series of mental events that would be sufficient for time even prior to the inception of the physical universe. So I think it is possible to have a kind of metaphysical time prior to creation, though I see no basis for postulating that sort of pre-creation time. And indeed, I don't think it could be infinitely extended. And therefore, I adopt Occam's razor here. You don't postulate entities or hypotheses beyond necessity. I think it's simpler simply to say that time began at the moment of creation. So on the model of time that I adopt, I argue that God without creation is timeless, but that he enters into time at the moment of creation in virtue of his causal relationships and knowledge of the temporal world.
And I guess you can't, so this might sound like a silly question. I know that there's this notion of quantum foam. Maybe this is one of the models you were talking about. That wouldn't be eternal, or it would be, because there would have to be like some cause that brought that into being, right? Or
yes, it can't be projected into the infinite past. Vilenkin himself tries to offer a quantum physical model to explain the origin of the universe. And these models, if they're to be consistent with the evidence, cannot be projected into past infinity. So the argument for the beginning of the universe doesn't depend on there being an initial cosmological singularity. You could have a quantum physical model of the origin of the universe that would not involve a singularity, but nevertheless, these are still past finite. They cannot be projected to past eternity and be physically adequate.
Excellent. And I know Ben just asked about the fine-tuning, the constants. I had a question about the mathematical, how you said the corroboration in mathematics, and how that's, and the fact that we can even do mathematics and how amazing that is. So one question I had was, and I know you've written a lot about this, and I know it's a long subject. So, but the idea of, is mathematics real? Because some people can make the argument that, well, mathematics and laws, physical law, everything came from physical laws. Maybe those are eternal. They're abstract. They're timeless. They're formless. Yep. So how would we respond to that?
Very good. This is, again, the argument from the applicability of mathematics to the physical world that I described. Eugene Wigner, the Nobel Prize-winning quantum physicist, presented this argument based upon what he called the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. And what Wigner noted is that mathematics is not pursued for reasons of empirical adequacy, the way scientific theories are. In science, you only postulate such entities as are warranted by the scientific evidence. But that's not the way mathematics works. Mathematics adopts maximal principles where you posit as many mathematical entities as you can, short of contradiction. And therefore, mathematics is pursued for what Wigner called aesthetic reasons, not empirical reasons, it having to do with mathematical beauty. Moreover, these mathematical entities, as you just described them, even if they exist, if you adopt a Platonic or realist view of these mathematical objects, they are by definition causally effete. That is to say, because they're abstract, they have no causal effect upon anything. Abstract objects like numbers and sets and functions and so forth exist beyond space and time, and they have no causal powers, and therefore they are impotent to affect the physical world. And this is one of the mysteries that Roger Penrose was so tortured by. How do you explain the fact that this abstract, causally effete mathematical realm is so descriptive of the physical phenomena which he as a physicist explores? And it seems to me that the best explanation is the one that Plato, in fact, gave, namely that God can look to the mathematical realm and fashion a world on the basis of the mathematical model that he prefers. And a view similar to this was defended by the ancient Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria, who was contemporaneous with the New Testament authors. Philo argued that the conceptual universe, the conceptual world, exists in the mind of God himself. It's not distinct from God, as Plato thought. Rather, these are divine ideas that exist in God's mind, and that God then fashions the physical universe on the basis of the mental model that he had in mind that he prefers. And I have argued that this theistic perspective provides a far more plausible explanation of the mathematical applicability to physical phenomena than naturalism is capable of. And I formulated the argument very simply in the following way. If God does not exist, then the applicability of mathematics to physical phenomena is just a happy coincidence. Premise two, the applicability of mathematics is not just a happy coincidence. Three, therefore God exists. I think that this is a surprisingly powerful argument for the existence of a transcendent, omniscient, cosmic creator.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot more rational sense than saying, as I've heard some suggest, that there were these numbers and forms, and God was just like chained to them. He had no choice. He had to obey these mathematical constructs. It makes more sense. They have no causal power, that he would be the originator of.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the infinite, or the realm of the mathematical, is infinite. And so it is not limited exclusively to one set of natural or mathematical laws. There would be an infinite variety for God to choose from. And so I don't think anyone can plausibly maintain that the laws of nature that physicists articulate are metaphysically necessary. The universe doesn't have to be described by these elegant mathematical laws. And in fact, physicists regularly toy with alternative models of the universe that would operate according to different mathematical laws, and they then see what would happen in these universes.
Thank you. That was amazing. And before we move to the next question, I wanted to get back to the Richard Dawkins part of it, because he, I was watching a documentary once and I was like flabbergasted. He was talking about DNA and how, you know, there is evidence for signature in DNA. I don't know if you've seen this before. And then he says, well, it must be that an extraterrestrial race, you know, created us or spawned our existence. First of all, could you explain to the audience what that means? What is this signature in DNA that he's talking about? And then his answer also, like, what is he trying to say?
The DNA that is at the basis of all life on this planet, from bacterial life up through human beings, exhibits roughly the same genetic code. And the possibility of this just coming together by accident is so remote that contemporary origin of life scientists have no explanation for where this came from or how it arose. And so some of them, in a move similar to the multiverse theorists, have appealed to outer space. If you multiply your probabilistic resources, then maybe on some planet, somewhere in the infinite universe, the DNA and RNA would accidentally come into being, and that might as well be our planet as well as some other. Or one could say that then it was transported to our planet by comets and meteors and asteroids, so that ultimately life came from outer space. Well, a couple of problems with that is that even if the entire observable universe were filled with what's called primordial soup, the odds against the chance origination of the genetic code are so remote that they would never have happened in the time available. But secondly, you run into the Boltzmann brain problem again. If you multiply your probabilistic resources to infinity, then how do you know that these organisms evolved on Earth at all? Maybe they just sprang into being fully formed, looking as though they had evolved, but in fact, evolution is an illusion. And if the theorist, like Dawkins, replies, well, no, that's absurd, that's too improbable for fully formed organisms to simply pop into existence without predecessors, the answer then would be, from the multiverse theorists, in an infinite universe, anything can happen, and indeed will happen an infinite number of times over. So that the appeal to extraterrestrial life actually turns out to completely undermine the theory of biological evolution and would make its adoption irrational.
Brilliant. So from my limited view, the acceptance of evolution among Christians seems rare. This perspective, however, seems more prevalent among some Orthodox Jewish scholars, such as Dr. Gerald Schroeder, who advocates for the notion of guided evolution. This stance appears less contentious within Jewish interpretation of the Genesis account compared to the Christian tradition. Dr. Craig, Can you articulate your position on this matter, how it harmonizes with biblical texts, and how you would counter skeptics like Dr. David Berlinski, who challenges the scientific validity of evolution based on its perceived mathematical improbability? One last related point I'd like you to address. You've been involved in defending the age of the universe as roughly 14 billion years old, which has been controversial in conservative Christian circles. What evidence pointed you in this direction?
Okay. To begin with, Ben, it's really important that we defend what we mean by the word evolution if we're not to lose our way in this discussion. The word evolution is a sort of accordion word that can be expanded or contracted to cover many different things. In contemporary evolutionary theory, the word is used in at least three different ways. One would be simply to say that all life on Earth is genealogically connected. That is to say that all of the living organisms are descended from a handful of primordial ancestors. And in that sense, evolution is widely, almost universally accepted today, even among Christians. I think that it is only the young Earth creationists who would deny that there is a history of the evolution of life in that sense on this planet. And they are in an increasingly dwindling minority, even among evangelical Christians, not to speak of the Christian community more broadly. So don't be misled by the highly public nature of some of these young Earth creationists. They really do represent a dwindling minority, even within evangelical circles. Now, the second way in which evolution can be understood is the reconstruction of the tree of life, determining which organisms branched off of which others and tracing this tree of life back to its root. This is hugely controversial today and by no means universally accepted. Indeed, Dawkins himself says that the debates among evolutionists on this reconstruction of the tree of life are so acrimonious that even some have despaired of Darwinism itself. So that is not universally agreed. And then the third area would be an account of the causal mechanisms that would go to explain the evolution of organisms. And this again is hugely controversial today. The old modern synthesis, sometimes called neo-Darwinism, is being increasingly challenged, and I think could even be said to be overthrown now, in favor of what's called the extended evolutionary synthesis, which posits additional causal mechanisms beyond just genetic mutations and natural selection. So when you look at skepticism among Christians concerning evolutionary theory, it is primarily directed at those second and especially the third way of understanding evolution. So for example, a theorist like Stephen Meyer, who is a colleague of David Berlinski, whom you mentioned, is very ready to accept the thesis of common ancestries, as this really needn't be a point of contention or dispute. What he disputes is the causal mechanisms that are at the root of the evolution of complex life forms. And so I think this would be the same for Berlinski. I think what Berlinski is challenging is the mathematical probability of these causal mechanisms producing in the limited time available the sort of biological diversity and complexity that we see. And this is, in fact, eminently challengeable and is a matter of tremendous dispute among evolutionary theorists themselves. Now, as to your last point about the age of the universe, again, this is only controverted by these young Earth creationists who are a dwindling minority within the evangelical community. The very fact that we can see light from stars billions of years away shows that the universe is older than 10 to 20,000 years of age, as young Earth creationists would assert. In order to explain the fact that we can see the stars, the young Earth creationist has to adopt the theory of apparent age. That is to say that God not only created the Earth and the distant stars, but he created the light ray in between them so that in the limited time available, we can see these stars, which are billions of light years away. And so ultimately, the young Earth creationist is reduced to accepting this wild hypothesis of the mere appearance of age, which just is to admit that the evidence on face value does suggest a very ancient universe.
Brilliant. And, you know, for us, when we read the Torah, we see, you know, the creation process, the sun was created on the fourth day. So clearly there's this idea of days as we know it is not applicable. Clearly talking about something, you know, as you were mentioning, there's clearly a 14 billion or whatever it is that the number is. It's clearly an old universe. And I really thank you for making the time. I want to also thank Dr. Brian Crawford, a friend of ours, who made the connection with you. That was really amazing. And we really wish you all the best. God bless you. And thank you for everything you do. And we hope to do this again one day.
Well, thank you, Ben and Zev. It's been a pleasure. And I just want to say, I realize that not all Jews are Zionists. But for my part, I want to express my personal support for Israel in this tremendous struggle in which it's engaged. I believe Israel has the right of defending its own security and national integrity. And so I stand fully behind her in its battle with Hamas.
Thank you so much.
We really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Well, have a great one. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
All right.
God bless.
Appreciate it. God bless. Bless.
Hey guys, thanks so much for tuning into the Judaism Demystified podcast. We really appreciate all your support and your feedback. If you want to help us grow the podcast, keep spreading the word, share it with your friends, family, or whoever you think would be interested. We also opened a Patreon, so you can become a patron, contribute any small amount you'd like, which would really help us grow the show. Our Patreon is www.patreon.com/Judaism. Pretty easy to remember. Thank you again, and we hope to keep putting out great shows for you guys. Before we go, we want to thank our Patreon supporters by name. Those are the supporters that are helping make this show happen because, frankly, Bensi and I are full-time workers who don't really have so much time on our hands because we have families, we have kids, and it's just a passion project that got way bigger than we expected. So we're dedicating more time to this, and obviously our production value up until this point hasn't been great, considering that we filmed this in Bensi's basement using a green screen and a crappy little microphone and not such great equipment, to be honest. I'm sure you all realize that. So we are hoping to up our quality and get better equipment. And part of that process is going to be due to you guys, the listeners and supporters. If you go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/Judaism, you will see all the different tiers of ways you can help us out. So first of all, we want to thank our super patron, Jordan Carmilli, our platinum patron, Craig Gordon, our gold patrons, David Chai Abramchayev, Laser Cohen, Travis Kruger, Vasily Volkov, silver patrons, Ellen Fleischer, Daniel Maksumov, Rabbi Pini Rosenthal, and Jeffrey Wasserman. Thank you all for supporting the show, and we hope you guys enjoy.